dead. Not. Not. Yet. If. He ha. Within this life. Eva. Certainly. Apachitum. Counteraction, atonement. Yata. Duly. Amhasakritasya. When one has performed sinful activities. Kuryat. Performs. Manaha. With the mind. Ukta. Words. Panaviki. And with the senses. Dhruvam. Undoubtedly. Saha. That person. Vai. Indeed. Pratya. After death. Nanakan. Different varieties of hellish conditions. Upaiti. Attains. Yay. Which. Kirtitaha. Were already described. May. By me. Bhavataha. Unto you. Adigma yatanaha. In which there is very terrible suffering. So translation, Shukadeva Goswami replied, my dear king, if before one's next death, whatever impious acts one has performed in this life, with his mind, words, and body are not counteracted through proper atonement, according to the description of the Manu Samhita and other Dharma Shastras, one will certainly enter the hellish planets after death and undergo terrible suffering, as I have previously described to you. So, purport by Zvangre, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions that although Maharaja Parikshit was a pure devotee, Shukadeva Goswami did not immediately speak to him about the strength of devotional service. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita in the 14th chapter, text 26, Mamchiyo vyavicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samati choitan ramabhuyaya kalpate. Devotional service is so strong that if one fully surrenders to Krishna and takes fully to his devotional service, I'm emphasizing those words so you don't get confused, the reactions of his sinful life immediately stopped. The operative word is fully. Elsewhere in the Gita, in the 18th chapter, text 66, Krishna urges that one give up all other duties. Notice I'm emphasizing certain words. And surrender to him. And he promises, aham tvam sarvapapebhyo moksha yishyami. I shall free you from all sinful reactions and give you liberation. God bless me. This is what happens when you're a guru. You can only bless yourself. So, therefore, in response, because everyone feels embarrassed to say it. So, anyway, in response to the inquiries of Parikshit Maharaj, Shukadeva Goswami, his guru, could have immediately explained the principles of bhakti. But to test Parikshit Maharaj's intelligence, he first described atonement according to Karmakanda, the path of fruitive activities. For Karmakanda, there are 80 authorized scriptures. You got to read them all. Such as the Manu Samhita, which are known as Dharma Shastras. In these scriptures, one is advised to counteract his sinful acts by performing other types of fruitive action. This was the path first recommended by Shukadeva Goswami to Maharaj Parikshit. And actually, it is a fact that one who does not take to devotional service must follow the decision of these scriptures by performing pious acts to counteract his impious acts. This is known as atonement. So, Sri Shuku Vacha Nachedi Hoiva Patitam Yatam Hasa Kritasya Kuryan Mana Ukta Prani Vihi Dhruvam savai pracha narakannu paiti yakutata me bhavatastigma yathanaha. So, Om Agana Timaranda Shagaranjana Shalakaya Chakshur Meditam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So, every religion has some form of atonement. Now, an atonement means that, like, you give up something that you're really attached to when you perform some austerities or even you torture the body because you feel remorseful, or at least you feel guilty, or at least you're scared. These words mean something different, actually. Like, remorseful means you've actually recognized what you've done is wrong. Guilty means, basically, you also recognize, not necessarily what you've done is wrong, but at least you recognize you've done something that you may get criticized for and lose your reputation. And scared means you're scared of the reaction. You understand? These are different reactions that people have, or different mental states that people have that cause them to do atonement. Just like in, Prabhupada gives the example of the Catholic Church. In the Catholic Church, they have their confession, which is a type of atonement. And they have, I don't know if you've ever seen this confessional booth. Isn't it? There's a screen between the priest and the person who's confessing, and the person sits down and says, "My Father, I have sinned." No, he also says, "Forgive you. God will forgive you," whatever. "My Father, I have sinned. This week, I drank liquor." Of course, the father will say, "I drink liquor too. What's the problem with that?" So, it has to be something like, There's different types of sins. There's cardinal sins, there's venial sins. I mean, there's different grades of sins, even in the Catholic tradition. Anyway, and so they go every Sunday, or whenever they go in the week. And actually, there was I think I mentioned this before, there was a movie many, many years ago. It was called Never on Sunday. It was about a prostitute who did her business, but on Sunday she was pious and atoned. We, you know, went to church. just like in Italy, they have mafia people. The original mafia is actually from India. But then Italy is like a perverted reflection. Anyway, so in Italy they have their mafia. The mafia are all real strict Catholics. I don't know if you know this. They go to church and they worship and everything like that. So, and then also atonement in different religions. Like in the Jewish religion, they have one day of atonement. They're actually much more efficient than the Catholics. Catholics, they, you know, every week you have to go. For the Jewish people, it's only one time a year. It's pretty good, isn't it? You can get away with any damn thing. You go one time a year. That's called Yom Kippur, is the Hebrew name of it. And it occurs about a few days after the Jewish New Year, which is called Rosh Hashanah. So they all go and they fast for half a day. And there's all these prayers, you know, "Forgive me, Lord, if I have sinned this year. Forgive me, forgive me, forgive me." And they're chanting like that. And they fast for half a day. In the middle of the day, they have a feast. And the Muslims, of course, they have a lot of things too. You know, they have month of Ramadan, where they fast the whole day and have their feast at night. And also, sometimes the Muslims, they actually beat each other with swords and make each other bloody. I don't know if you've seen this. You haven't seen this? That's what I mean. They beat themselves with swords, and there's blood coming out all over the place. You never seen this? You've seen this, Govardhan, haven't you? Pictures of that. They actually, I saw it in the movie, but it actually happens. Actually, I mean, I didn't see it in person. I didn't see it in the movie. I saw it in the news, you know. And, you know, because in Iraq, there are actually this group of Muslims that just go to, and the Christians, sometimes they self-flagellation like that, or they wear these hair shirts, you know, the real torture. Or the Christian monks actually had a whole bunch of different things that they used to do. The racks that they would lay on, you know, where they would stretch the body. It's good for the back, actually. And then they would, another thing they would do is they would go into these sarcophagi. I don't know if you know what a sarcophagi is. It's like it's shaped like a body, and they would have pins sticking in from both sides, and you just close it, and the person just... You've seen that? You've seen that in movies. I saw it in person. I didn't see a person do it, but I actually saw it, the old ones, you know, the replicas from the monasteries. And in the monasteries, they would execute really severe austerities, you know, the Catholic monastery. So anyway, so this is what atonement is. But this is not really so useful. The reason Shukadev Goswami is presenting this to Maharaj Pariksit, his disciples, just to test to see if he understands Krishna consciousness. You know, he says atonement, and if Maharaj Pariksit had said, yeah, you're right, then Maharaj Pariksit would have failed the test. So the guru sometimes tests the disciple. It's really interesting. I mean, I've given this example before. One time there was a disciple who approached Prabhupada, and he said, Srila Prabhupada, I want to take sannyasi, I want to be a sannyasi. And Prabhupada said, you know, I think you should get married. And then the next day, you know, the devotee was presenting Prabhupada with his fiance. Prabhupada, do you approve of this? You know, huh? So the guru tests the disciple, because tests are actually good to help one learn things. So the guru may say things that are wrong just to see if the disciple is listening, you know. Like saying, you know, up is down and down is up, and then everyone in Bhagavatam class is just sitting, yes, Maharaj, yes. Like another thing Prabhupada did is that, you know, he was walking on the beach, and, you know, and then... they saw a big building. Prabhupada said, in the future we'll have a big building. They saw big cars. In the future we'll have big cars. And everyone did jai, Prabhupada. Yes, Prabhupada, yes. And then finally Prabhupada said, saw a big dog. And then he said, Prabhupada said, in the future we will have big dogs like this. And everyone went, jai, Prabhupada. You know, but they weren't listening, you know. Because Prabhupada says, you know, absurd inquiries and, you know, blind following are to be condemned. He says that in the Gita. So anyway, one has to use their brain and listen. That's the real point. So Shukadeva Goswami is testing his disciple, and we understand that actually this atonement process of austerity doesn't really work, because, as will be explained later on, that it doesn't purify the heart. And the thing that causes us to perform sinful activities, kama, asha, krodha, asha, rajaguna, samudra, is lust. And the lust is coming or manifest because of what's called papa bijam. And we're not talking about daddy, sinful daddy, you know, papa bijam. But papa means sin, and bijam means seed. So there's different types of karma. You know, you have karma that's almost mature, karma that's, you know, mature, karma that's lying in seed. And that what that means is there's a desire to perform certain activities. You don't experience it right now, that desire, but it's just waiting to sprout. And we all have all those desires. They're just waiting to sprout in the right situation. That's why sometimes you may go to sleep and you'll experience, like, things that you didn't think you had that desire anymore, right? You may experience, you know, jumping out of an airplane and skydiving. Anyway, so sometimes we're actually going along in life, like a brahmachari is going along in life for 20 years and thinking, you know, and then along comes a lady. And she goes, with her eyebrows and then. And he goes, oh. And the ladies too, they have the same thing. Like the lady, ladies are vulnerable too. I was just communicating with one lady, she was saying that one man praised her and she felt, she melted. You know what I'm saying? Melted? Like, with the sunshine. Can you close the curtains or something? The sun is actually my eyes right now. Reflected on that picture over there. That's good. Okay. So anyway, so she was thinking, you know, I'm sorry, she's in Vrindavan serving Krishna. And then man comes up and says, you know, you're really special to me. Because that's a desire seeking. Or, you know, we're not experiencing attraction to any food, and then all of a sudden food comes, and then food doesn't come by itself. But anyway, you go someplace where there's food, and all of a sudden, huh, the tongue goes out of control. Or we're not angry, but all of a sudden someone says something that stimulates our anger, we get angry at them. So, you know, all these things are lying there as seed. Just like in the early days of the movement, we thought if you fast a lot, then you get rid of your lust. You know, there's always the thing, you know, you fast a lot. And even one devotee wrote a book, The Joys of No Sex, anyway. And he wrote about all these methods of trying to get rid of your lust, like before you go to sleep at night, fill your bathtub with ice cubes. Hang upside down, you know. You know, eat one chickpea a day or something like that. But the point is, yes, while you're fasting and stuff like that, the lust doesn't become manifest. Obviously, you're too weak. You know, you haven't eaten, you're just sitting there. And it's like, I have no lust. I've actually become free from material desires. Isn't it? I mean, I think people have experienced that. Like on Janmashtami, it's hard to get angry. At least for me, you know. Because you're fasting the whole day. By the time it's the afternoon, someone can insult me and I'd say, yeah. Krishna's mercy. That doesn't mean I'm free of anger. It just means, you know, I'm not capable of expressing it at that particular moment. That's all it means. But then, as soon as I have, you know, full stomach, then someone says something to me, ah, you rascal. I immediately respond. Isn't it? You've experienced that? Like when you're tired, you know, sometimes you can say, all right, leave me alone. You know, I just want to go to sleep. Just go away. But in the morning when you have a lot of energy, you're really feisty, you know, really cheeky or whatever it is. So the point is that these desires are there in the heart, and the only way to get rid of them is by devotional service. And of course, this is later explained in this chapter by Shukadeva Goswami in this famous verse. I think it's the 15th verse in this chapter, if I remember correctly. He says, Tasmat Sankirtanam Vishnu Jangan Mangalamang Asam Mahatama Pikaravya Vidyakantika Nishkritam. Let me just check and see if that's the 15th verse. I think it is the 15th verse, if I'm right. Whoops. No, it's not the 15th. Anyway, it's later on. It's later on here. So it says, so what that verse states is, Tasmat, therefore, Sankirtanam Vishnu, therefore the Sankirtan for Lord Vishnu, Jangan Mangalang Amasam, is the most auspicious thing for this sinful universe. And actually, the word Sankirtan is interesting. It means, in one sense, you know, Sangha Kirtan, even. But it also means another thing. Did you know that? Does anyone else know what it means? Does it mean taking prasadam? No. Actually, the word tsang means complete in Sanskrit. So sankirtan. So you can understand two ways, like sangha or sang. Sang also is the root of the word sangha. That means complete with everybody. But without the extra part, you know, sang could also mean complete. So it means complete chanting, basically. What does that mean, complete chanting? That means absorption in chanting. Just like we have this offense in chanting, what is it, the inattentive chanting, which is the source of all the other offenses. I mentioned this before, that inattentive chanting is of different types. It's you're thinking of something else, you're not, your mind is wandering, or you're just spaced out and you're not really trying to concentrate, or you're going to sleep. Those are the different types of offensive chanting. So the point is, and there's the same thing as Prabhupada's mentioned here, like he uses these absolute terms here, that one fully surrenders to Krishna. That's pretty heavy, isn't it? What is fully surrender to Krishna? It means, Krishna, I'm yours. You may crush me by your embrace. You may do anything and everything, but you always remain my worshipful Lord unconditionally. Less than that means, you know, Krishna, if you do what I want, you know, that's fine, but, you know, otherwise, I'll do what I want. Anyway, so fully surrender means like the last verse in the Shikshashika. That's fully surrender. The actual Shikshashika takes through various stages of devotional service. In the Bhajan Mahasha, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and other literatures, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, analyze the different stages of devotional service in terms of the verses of the Shikshashika. And so the final verse of the Shikshashika is actually the highest stage of devotional service, which is absolute surrender to the Lord. If you want to understand absolute surrender, you study the last verse. Anyway, so like Prabhupada says, one fully surrenders to Krishna, takes fully to his devotional service. So the point is when one fully chants, I mean, that's sankirtan, means fully, full chanting, full absorption, no offenses, like that, complete attention, complete focus. So tasmat sankirtanam vishnu jangan mangalam anghasam, we describe what that is, the most auspicious thing for this impious world, jangan, or impious universe, mahatamapi karavya, that the great souls, they prescribe this, and also it also means the great souls do it. Mahatamapi, also the great souls, karavya, vidyakantaka nishkritam, it's the best atonement. Why is it the best atonement? Because you get rid of all the papabijams from your heart. And then you don't have the inclination to do anything else. Otherwise, Sukadeva Goswami later on in this chapter describes it as kunjara sochara, the bathing of an elephant. An elephant bathes, it rolls in the dirt again, then it bathes and rolls in the dirt. What's the use of such a procedure? So what's the use of atonement? Because you're going to do the sin again. So let's translate this into practical action for ourselves. Let's say we do something that's not kosher. I don't think you know what that word means. But anyway, does anyone know what that word means? It's a Jewish word. It means, you know, let's not even say proper, but it doesn't contribute to your advancement in spiritual life. How about that? Because if you simply use the word bad and good, you know, just like, sometimes we like to be bad, so... Isn't it? It's fun to be bad. So if you say you're doing something bad, then you'll think, oh, yeah, leave me alone, it's cool. You know, just like in America, if you say, that's a really bad motorcycle, that means it's a cool motorcycle. Did you ever hear that expression here?
Yeah.
That's a modern expression. When I was young, they never used it. You know, you're really bad.
It's not about Michael Jackson.
Really? I never listened to any of his music because I don't like the way he looks. But he hasn't figured out whether he's white or black. You know.
Yeah, wicked.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about these things. All I know in America is they say that's really bad, and that means it's good. But anyway, so we did something bad. First of all, that doesn't really help us, because it's just a judgment, you know. And then after a while you start to think, if you did something bad, I'm a bad person, right? That doesn't help you either. So when you start judging yourself, that doesn't help you rectify your activities. I did something bad. Yesterday I did something bad. I'm a really bad person. And then you get to these other things. What? I'm hopeless, useless. Krishna will never love me. Might as well give it all up. You know, if I'm going to be bad, I'm going to enjoy it. I don't want to just be bad and just, you know, feel guilty about the whole thing. Isn't it? Might as well enjoy being bad. So that's what happens when you get into judgment. You understand what I mean? Because then you actually have, you know, you don't have any self-esteem, or you lose your self-esteem, and you get depressed, and you say, woe is me, and then you start singing the blues. You know what the blues are?
Yeah.
Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows the sorrow. You know, it's American genre of music. I like that. The blues, singing the blues. So, yeah, then you start singing the blues, and then you feel bad about yourself, and then you become hopeless, and then you don't have any impetus to perform devotional service. like that. As soon as you get into that depressed state, and then the doc, you go to the doctor, he gives you Prozac, and you feel better. Well, you're taking Prozac. At least you think you feel better while you're taking Prozac, and get addicted to Prozac, and then what happens when you get addicted to Prozac? What happens? Can't come off it. It's just like, you know, you got to get your Prozac today. So anyway, so it's really not good to say. What I find is not good to think in terms of that was a bad thing I did. I usually think that was not productive in terms of my spiritual advancement. I mean, that's more practical for me. And I think, you know, that thing actually would interfere with my spiritual advancement. And then you can actually think more strategically at that point. Because as soon as you get into this bad stuff, it doesn't help you think strategically. So anyway, so let's say you do something that's not so good for your spiritual advancement. Like you drink some liquor. You know, you're going in to preach at the bar one night to the people, and you see the vodka, and you go, like that. And then, yeah, like we were talking about, even if we were talking about garlic last night. You know, devotees say, garlic is bad. It's not bad. It actually has its use, too. You know, it has uses, an antiseptic, antibiotic, antiviral, all those nice things. So, but the reason we don't take garlic, you heard the explanation last night, because it doesn't contribute to our spiritual advancement. That's all. It's not that it's bad. We have nothing against garlic. It's a nice vegetable, you know, or whatever, or plant. Doesn't smell too good. Helps you maintain brahmacharya status if you eat it. Because no girl will come near you, right? I mean, it has some productive uses. You know, without eating, you can actually rub it all over your body, Rupa, and then you'll never have to worry about getting married. We had one girl who took it when she was sick. She took it because she was sick, and she was a Sankirtan girl, and then she was getting in the van with all the brahmacharis to go on Sankirtan. And the brahmacharis had to stick their heads out the window while they were driving. The van smelled like an Italian pizzeria. Anyway, so the point is, if we think in terms of things that are productive or not productive to our spiritual life, it actually becomes a lot easier not to become depressed and actually, you know, do things. So let's say we ate garlic. That's a more practical thing than drinking liquor, because most of us don't get into drinking liquor. Let's say we just, you know, really had some nice pakoras last night with garlic. So then, what do? We say, well, that was not helpful for my spiritual advancement because this morning I feel completely ignorant. I woke up at 10 o'clock instead of, you know, 4. And my breath is really bad. And how am I going to explain it when I give Bhagavatam class, you know? You know, that's why the devotees have to sit so far away. And they go, ah. It's a fact. Actually, if someone's taking garlic, I've experienced it, and they come in the temple room, the whole temple room, you can smell it. So, isn't it? That's a really strong odor. So anyway, you recognize it. I made a mistake. I'm not bad, but I made a mistake. You know, as soon as you get into the bad, you know, I'm bad, then you're not taking responsibility for your action anymore. It's just that I'm bad, and the reason that I took the garlic is because I'm bad. That's called an excuse, right? Do you understand what I mean?
Yes.
Why didn't you chant, Rupa? Because I'm in Maya. You know, why are you in Maya? You know, Maya is very strong. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, you know, Mama Maya Durachaya. Mm-hmm. So don't blame me. It was Maya made me do it. Or the Christians say, the devil made me do it. You ever hear that before?
Yeah.
The devil made me do it. So the Maya made me do it. The devil made me do it. I'm in Maya. Why'd you do that? I'm a conditioned soul. That's another good excuse I hear all the time. You know, that, yeah, it's Kali Yuga. That's a good excuse too. So I tell people, well, I get up early in the morning. That's because you're a pure devotee. If that's like an indirect excuse, you know, because I'm a rascal, they're saying, you know, there's implicit in that statement, I'm a rascal, you're a pure devotee, you can do it, but I'm not, you know, so I can't do it. So you come up with millions of excuses, and none of them actually entail taking responsibility for your actions. You understand? So in other words, you've got to take responsibility. I chose to do this, but this activity, not that I, you know, I'm a demon, anything for it. I chose to do something that's not helping me accomplish my goal. And of course, if your goal is not to become Krishna conscious, maybe it is helping you to accomplish your goal, to drink liquor. If your goal is just to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you may die, then sure, you know, but identify your goal. You know, identify, you know, strategic planning, internal strategic planning. You know, what is your mission, you know, life's mission? To become Krishna conscious and love Krishna. I mean, that's my life's mission, basically. And then there's some other things that go along with that, you know, strategic planning, that strategic goals and everything like that, that I achieve to accomplish the ultimate goal. So anyway, so if your life's mission, so then I just say this is not productive to achieving my goal. All right, fine. So that's the next step you take. And then the next step is you actually don't have to atone. You don't have to just like punish yourself, because then that's also doesn't help you change the activity. You know, I ate garlic last night. Let me fast for 3 days. You know, you're still going to have a taste for garlic. So instead, what you do is you actually make some arrangements so it doesn't happen again. You know, what that means is you never go to an Italian restaurant again. Or you keep a devotee with you all the time, you know, when you reach out the supermarket to get the garlic bulb, you know, he stops you or something like that. So you actually adjust things so it doesn't happen again. And then, of course, you also chant to purify the heart. But there are external things you got to do, too, recognizing your inclinations towards these things. You know, you take some association. And as well as the chanting, there's some external things you have to do. So that's how you deal with something that's not productive in attaining Krishna consciousness. Not judgment, not atonement, but some practical activity like that. And also, another point, if what you've done has hurt another person, there's a further step, which is, you know, compensation to the person. Let's say I got angry at Navadweep and I beat him or something like that. That would be nice. What kind of culture do you come from? Where love is shown by beating, you know? That's the Fiji culture. Anyway, so, you know, just like when I came to Fiji, I gave one heavy class, and Vishnu said, Maharaj, always preach like that, you know, chastise us. And I said, I can't do that. I'll have a heart attack if I do that every day. So let's say I hit him, and I realize it really wasn't productive towards his Krishna consciousness or my Krishna consciousness. Okay, you can apologize, but that's not it. Now, apology is just like 1/10 of the whole thing, because children always apologize for things that they did, and they don't mean it. Just like you go to a child and he does something wrong. Apologize for it. Tell me you're sorry. Tell me you're sorry. I'm sorry. You ever see that?
Yeah.
But they ain't sorry. Yeah, they're not sorry. I mean, they're just trying to get you off their back. That's all they're trying to do. Never tell a child that. Say you're sorry. Because it doesn't work. It just makes the children evasive and liars and everything like that. But the parents do it all the time, isn't it? Say you're sorry. They're not sorry. But anyway, recognize how what you've done has hurt someone. And there can be an apology too, but, you know, actually do some compensation to them. You know, whether it means, I'm not saying you have to give everybody money, compensate them, but just serve them. Do something actually positive in response. But there has to be recognition of how the other person felt when you did that particular thing. Listen to how the other person explains what his feelings were. Say, you know, when I did this, Navadweep, how did you feel? And Navadweep would say, that was great, Maharaj. And Guru did. Anyways, no, but seriously, when I did this, you know, what were your feelings? And Navadweep would say, you know, I felt very much painful because, you know, I just have a need for loving reciprocation or something like that. So just that, actually be empathic with the person and express your empathy. That may be all the compensation the person needs. And usually it is all the compensation. He doesn't need a present, you know, here, let me give you a teddy bear. Or or a shirt with Lord Vishnu's picture on it as a present. But so anyway, these are the ways of dealing with activities that are not Krishna conscious, don't contribute to our Krishna consciousness. And that's the way I like to see sin. Like that. Why don't I sin? Because it doesn't contribute to my goal in life. Not because it's bad, and not because, you know, the Yamadutis are going to come and drag me away and torture me like hell. Because that won't keep me from doing it. Even though I know, you know, that's the conditioned soul may know these things, but he keeps on doing them. Like Krishna asked, Arjuna asked Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, why, what is one impelled to act as if by force? And Krishna answers, Kamesha, Krodesha, Rajaguna, Samubhava. As the, you know, the mode of passion and kama, lust and everything. So you know, really it doesn't work just to understand you did something bad. You have to really go through these different steps, which I mentioned. And ultimately, atonement by chanting, which is what Shukadeva Goswami finally says. So any questions or comments? Yeah. Yes.
So wouldn't it make logical sense that if you do eat foods in the mode of goodness, then even though there may be some sinful desires in the heart, they're not going to come out.
So and in other words, you get it'll give you more time. Yeah, that's a good point. It'll give you more time to deal with the sinful desires in the heart. You understand? It gives you a little bit more time. But I'm not saying one should engage in harsh austerities. Yeah. You know, just like eat nothing because you have so much lust. Because that's not going to work. That's not going to give you the energy to perform devotional service. Yes, it is true that you know, overeating, just like we find in the nectar of instruction, you know, vacho vegam, manasa krodha vegam, jiva vegam, udara pashta vegam, that, you know, when you eat too much, Prabhupada explains, you know, then there's pressure on the, you know, the tongue, belly, genitals, they're in a straight line, Prabhupada explains there. So one has to be aware of these things too. But it's not the ultimate solution. It's a temporary adjustment so that you can continue your Krishna consciousness. It's not; it doesn't solve the problem. You know, eating very little doesn't solve the problem. It may give you good health, but it doesn't solve your lust problem or anger problem. Like that, like I mentioned that when I was a new devotee, we would all take tons of sweets on Sunday night. And then on Monday morning, we had low blood sugar, so everybody was angry as hell at each other. I mean, it's dangerous to be a brahmachari. Did you ever experience that in the yasha? Everybody would eat gulab jamuns on Sunday night. You don't eat gulab jamuns? You don't know what that is. Oh, we ate so... You don't know what it is to eat gulab jamuns. You know, I would eat like 10 on Sunday night, along with my sweet rice. Yeah, a little big ones. We're not talking about your little tiny ones that you get now, but they were like this big. I would actually go after the Sunday feast, see if the guests left some over on their plates. And, you know, the idea was prasadam is always pure. It's never contaminated. We had the saints, so we go along the guest plates. And, wow, I got all the gloves. That's why I like to clean up after the Sunday feast. Yeah, clean up. And I got all that. We all did that. I mean, it's not... I mean, I would wake up in the middle of the night after the Sunday feast and go to the prasadam refrigerator and take more. I think I told that story. You know, I woke up and then I was caught by Sasrup Maharaj at that time. You know, because there was a whole jar of sweet rice. I was thinking of, as I went to sleep, I was thinking, you know, I got to wake up at midnight. So I woke up and eventually devotees started putting locks on the refrigerator. Do they do that here in Sydney Temple? Or? Oh, that's not good. But I never did that. But I always take with the maha. So you like jars or glasses. You know, I'd fill this glass with sweet rice, three or four glasses. And next morning, Monday, was also a nectarian day if there's anything left over. So obviously, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, people were angry or sleepy or something the next day. So you got to adjust those things. And we did eventually, as you see in my diet. Took me about 40 years, but I learned my lesson. So that's the point. You know, yes, some adjustment can be there, but not as atonement. Not that you're, you know, feeling so bad or just like thinking yourself as a demon or flagellating yourself, or lying on a bed of nails. You know, that's what sometimes in brahmacharya we do that. You know, I'm so sinful, so I don't even shouldn't even use a mat when I'm sleeping at night. So we just sleep on the floor without a mat, without a cover like that, because we felt so bad about ourselves. But, you know, after a while, you find out that that doesn't work. You understand? Don't feel, just like it says, hate the sin, not the sinner. So that applies to ourselves, too. You understand? Because with ourselves, we shouldn't hate ourselves, we should love ourselves. But, you know, not like that particular activity because it doesn't contribute to our Krishna consciousness. So, Radha Shalini, you have a question?
It's one thing where you feel bad about yourself. How do you deal with devotees who are constantly negative and always saying how bad a certain behavior is about other devotees?
Yeah,
how do you deal with devotees like that? Who always forever
criticizing. Well, I think, you know, empathy is actually a very good tool. We can understand. Actually, I give a course about that. But we can understand their motivation behind that. What is their motivation? Maybe they're looking for love. You know, maybe they're very lonely and looking for love. It's their way to reach out. I mean, just like a child, sometimes he wants attention. What does a child do? He throws a tantrum, does naughty things. I remember, for example, when my brother was born, he was born 3 years after me. I was extremely upset because before that I was like everything to my mother. Any of you have that experience in life? You know, you were first child and then there was a second child after that? No. But anything, I was everything. My mother, you know, I was my little mother's baby and everything. And then all of a sudden, she doesn't love me anymore. And because of that, I developed certain skills. I use that word deliberately. You know, like practical joking and everything like that. You know, I started putting cups on the door frame, you know, full of water, so my mother would open the door, would fall on her head. Do you ever do that? No one here has ever done anything like that. And then I would tie a little thread to like a toy rat and pull it across the floor. You know, to make her scream, there's a rat in the room. So anyways.
Nimai used to do things like this.
Really? Nimai, which one? Lord Chaitanya, yeah.
Many jokes, not those ones,
but. Don't compare me to Lord Chaitanya. But I did it, well, it's not that I was evil or anything like that. I did it because I wanted love from my mother and I was feeling neglected. You understand? So when dealing with people, they really want something that's bona fide. And they're in pain. You know, someone is criticizing all the time. Of course, not all the time. They're sleeping sometimes. But someone is criticizing, you know, more than you would like. They're in pain. They're actually in extreme pain. So we just feel for them. You know, you're in pain because you for recognition, appreciation, it's a whole bunch of things that it could be. Or maybe they just didn't eat enough or something.
I mean, it's easy to deal with them when they're criticizing someone else, but what if they're criticizing you?
Same thing.
Same thing,
because they can't. And one thing I do, an additional thing when I criticize, when people say things about me that I don't appreciate, is that, I deliberately in that say the word criticize me. They say things about me that I don't appreciate. As I understand that they don't know me.
That's right.
Like I said the other day, no one's seen me.
That's right.
You can't see me.
Yeah.
You don't know what's happening in my heart.
That's right.
You know, so therefore, they're actually criticizing themselves rather than me. Mm-hmm. They're projecting, like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, I see so many faults in others because I myself am pockmarked with those same faults. So, I mean, what do they see? So then, and that's an additional step. And then I do the whole empathy thing with them. I just see that they have some need that's not being fulfilled. Any emotion that causes pain, and I'm not saying a negative, there's no negative emotions, because all emotions actually indicate something. It's not negative. But any emotion that's painful emotion, like sadness or something like that, indicates a need that's not being met by the person, some personal direct need, whether it's food or whether it's love, whether it's appreciation, or you know, something like that, then you can actually feel some empathy for the person. You know, you're saying this because you actually need appreciation. And sometimes if you go to the person and express that directly, without telling them what they need, you don't want to tell people what they need. You want to say, is it that you actually, need, some recognition or appreciation? You know, for a devotee that's hard, recognition or appreciation. But, you want people to see that you're actually interested in serving Krishna. And the person will say yes. And you'll find that. If you go to any of these people who have these websites, I mean, there's many, many websites that just like one thing after another, that critical of other devotees. There's even one magazine, Back to Prabhupada. Have you seen the magazine, Back to Prabhupada? The Rific magazine. They send it out to just about everybody. And this has, the latest installment of the ISKCON guru who happened to sneeze and used his left hand to hold the tissue instead of the right hand. Or something like that. Not quite that bad, but I mean, they really get into the nitty-gritty. And so you understand, these people are in pain. There's something. There's some thing they want, security, or they feel disconnected from Prabhupada, or whatever, They're in pain, so you can actually have compassion for them. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it so bad to have relationships with devotees where people start perceiving your relationships with other devotees as you're having affairs with them?
Yeah, well, sometimes...
A person with multi-million men or women, you're having affairs with everybody you talk to? Have a friendly personality or something like that?
Yeah, well the thing... let me explain something about our movement or Indian culture or, the way devotees perceive things. Is that we like to just pass judgment on people. Mm-hmm. It's a very judgmental type of attitude that pervades Indian culture and also our movement. We have all these nice names for people like demons or, rascals or what?
Karmi,
meat eater, rakshasa. Or or we can say, in terms of your activity, you're having an affair, who knows what you're doing, all those other things. So it's a low trust culture, basically. Mm-hmm. It's really a low. That's what I find.
Yeah.
It's a very low trust culture. I mean, there was one proposal that sannyasis should always have someone with them spying on them, but it didn't say spying, but observing, watching them for their own safety, it's like being in a fishbowl. It's being in a fishbowl. And so, the culture tends to be very low trust, and then it's not a pleasant culture to live in. We have a need, that's a basic human need, to be trusted. Actually, I was just dealing with this. In Fiji, there was one family, and they have an adult daughter. And, they just break into her room all the time to see what she's doing. And she's not doing anything bad. But they just don't trust her. It's just like... And the girl feels so bad that maybe because they don't trust her, she may act in a way that's untrustworthy, if someone projects that on you, you're just a rascal, We have to make sure, tie you up, put one of those, what are those things, those electronic collars on you, like they put on criminals?
Yeah, yeah.
They have them here too?
Yeah.
They will see you. Also, there's something you can buy and you put in your child's, on the car of your child, so it actually tells you where he or she's gone, how fast they've gone, right? A tracking device, GPS tracking device. You plug it into the USB port of the computer when they come back and you see that, Radha Shalini is actually gone to Govinda's,
What? Now you can see them live.
Live. That's more expensive. That's a subscription service. But the cheaper one is just one-time pay and you just plug it in. But the subscription is $9 a month. I already checked it out. because I have all my disciples, I have one for you. That's why I spend time on the internet, you know, just seeing where Krishna Rupa is, you know, what she's doing. You know, but actually Prabhupada says when you have a child at a certain age, they're your friend. You can't treat them like they're rascals anymore. And whatever they do, they, you know, if you give them freedom, they're going to get in trouble. So I was dealing with this situation. The poor girl is traumatized because her mother is just thinking, you know, and the father is thinking this and that, you know, you're just a rascal, you know. So one day she went, I don't know if I should tell the story, but anyway, I shouldn't record this one. But anyway, one day, you know, she went out and she came back late and the father wanted to take her to the hospital to have a test. To see if she had any relationship. I mean, just, huh? How can you deal with people like that? Human beings, you know, like a low-trust culture. So anyway, so somehow or other in our society, in Indian society like that, traditional Indian, it's very much controlling, low-trust culture. And I have trouble living in such a culture like that. You know, I know, just like the Indian culture. I have trouble living in ISKCON culture like that. You know, I want to be trusted. You know, I'm, you know, if I'm at Govardhan, you know, then alone, you know, I'm all right, you know, so that someone has to watch me that I'm going and kissing Govardhan, you know, without their permission. Anyways, I'm in a relationship with Govardhan. Anyways, you know, there has to be some basic trust. And Prabhupada extended that trust when Prabhupada was on the planet. But then when Prabhupada left, things became more, another point is things become more institutionalized. It becomes more less trust in the culture. You don't empower people as much. Everything becomes, you know the assessments, you know, now they're talking about 360 assessments, 360-degree assessments. I mean, that makes me nervous. Because, I mean, I don't mind some assessment. You know, the peer is telling me, you know, Maharaj, you know, you're not pronouncing your japa properly or something like that. But, you know, 360 assessment is a real problem because then you got people who are peers sometimes and they give you bad assessments because they don't want you moving up the corporate ladder.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Yes. Yeah.
Even though they talk about these assessments being nice. And sometimes you have superiors who want to keep you down because they don't want to lose their position.
Yeah.
So, you know, people are not exactly unmotivated when they're giving these assessments. There's also always personal motivation. Not always, but generally. Personal motivation. So, yeah, that's a real problem. That's a real problem. And I just express to people, I have a need to be trusted. If you want to work with me, you have to, you know, trust me. Otherwise, I'm not interested in working in such a situation where I'm not trusted. And if I do something that's not productive for my Krishna consciousness, you know, that's my problem. That's my problem. I mean, of course, in the position of guru, you are in a fishbowl to a certain extent, you know. If people see me going to the movies with a girlfriend, you know, then obviously it's not such a good idea. You know, you have to have an open... A sannyasi actually has to be in a position where they're...
Do you say something to these people who think like that about you? Do you approach them in a way
where... No. I just say you don't know... I just think you don't know me. I mean, I mean, for example, I used to be GBC in Hawaii, and they wanted, you know, some of the interesting personalities there. They wanted to get rid of me because I was tightening screws there. I was getting people to chant japa and follow a few of the regulated principles. When I first became GBC in Hawaii, the pujaris, they were having affairs at night. I don't know if any of you have been to the Hawaii temple, anybody? So there's these little cabins on the property.
Yeah.
So the pujari, lady pujaris were having boyfriends over at night. And, you know, I got there, and the male pujari, so male, they were smoking marijuana and going surfing. So I got there, and I couldn't eat anything anyone cooked. I just had to go on raw food the first time in my life. And this was years ago. Because, if you eat food cooked by someone who's smoking marijuana, having illicit sex, you know. And so then I started kicking people out of the temple. I said, you know, either straighten up or hit the road. Hit the road, Jack or Jill. Anyway, so we started doing that, and then we made some enemies by doing that. And then they started passing rumors, you know, Maharaj is just coming to Hawaii just to go to the beach to see the pretty girls on the beach.
Oh.
And you know, first of all, I went to the beach maybe one time each trip. Second of all, if I take my glasses off, I can't tell the difference between a pretty girl and a pretty man, you know. You know, so it's not. And third of all, it's not even interested in that stuff. You know, I didn't join the Krishna conscious movement for that stuff. But so they actually came out with, and they accused me of being a murderer too. A murderer, yeah. Because yeah, in the past we had one girl in North Carolina committed suicide. What happened? She was from a Gujarati family. The family wasn't appreciative. She joined the movement, giving her all sorts of guilt trips. And then finally, she walked into the river we have on our property and drowned herself. I mean, it's traumatic for me. I mean, she was a very dear disciple. And I was actually, you know, crying and everything like that. And later on, the parents apologized for that, for doing that to her. They understood they had caused her death. Because she left a note like that, you know, don't blame Guruji or whatever. So anyway, so they found out about that. And then they accused me of burning a murderer, murdering disciples. Murdering disciples, having affairs with disciples, and murdering them. So, I mean, I felt compassionate to them, but I thought, you know, this is Krishna's indication I don't belong here. So immediately I called up Ravindra Swarup Prabhu and said, you should be the GBC of Hawaii. I think you need it for your health. You understand? You know, I think you need a warm place you can go, you know, recuperate your health. And so he said, you really think so, Maharaj? I said, yes, good. And then so he became GBC. Why? He lasted about 2 years in Hawaii. Hawaii has always been a problem. And now, because before me was Kavi Chandramars, he had the same treatment. And I even had a lawsuit, and I had to sign an agreement that Kavi Chandramars would never become GBC of Hawaii again. And so now Devamrita Maharaj is the next GBC of Hawaii. Devamrita Maharaj? Yeah, because that's natural. He travels between, you know, New Zealand and Australia and the United States, so it's natural. So he's an ex-GBC of Hawaii, but he actually says, I don't want anything to do with this stuff. So you do find a lot of people, I mean, also because of the institutional paradigm, a lot of people who are angry. Institutional paradigm, this is very interesting. That means one day they were living in the temple. And they were getting taken care of. All their knees were getting taken care of. It was like little babies with a bottle, you know. Can I have my toothbrush, temple president? Can I, you know, please, may I, you know, pretty please. May I take prasadam now? You know, they're living like in a dependence, adults living in a dependent situation. This is called institutionalization in sociology. It's like a prison. Or like the army or something like that. You ever seen people join the army, they're in for 20 years, they can't function when they get out. But not only can't they function, they're resentful because the army's not taking care of them anymore. So you find this whole group of devotees who have actually grown up, and it's not really their fault, they've actually been indoctrinated with the idea that ISKCON's like the big mother that's supposed to take care of them. And, you know...
Well, the same thing is now, like in the case of after the accident,
yeah.
There is expectation that that's going to pay their bills, which I don't know what...
But she's an independent grihasta.
Yeah, but there's a big hoo-ha going that ISKCON should pay her bills, but I don't think ISKCON should pay
her. No, ISKCON should pay her. She had her own house there. Prajaseviki almost threw me out of Mayapur one time, but that's another story. I told you the story. It was really interesting. I was living with a household couple there in the ashram. What?
Were you living with
Braj Prem? Yeah, Braj Prem, yeah.
Because them two don't get along.
Yeah, that's maybe the problem. And she said, Mara, we don't want sannyasis in our area. Get out. And I said, no. Households are supposed to host sannyasis. Anyway, that's another issue. So, I mean, you can understand. I can empathize why she's thinking the way she's thinking, or people are thinking why they should pay the hospital bills, because you've been maintained, and you have this implicit promise when you're living in an institution that they'll take care of you for the rest of your life. I don't make that promise to people. I tell, you know, you're here, you can do whatever service, but we're not promising we're going to maintain you.
What if you're still a full-time, like Rupa and Rupa's guys?
Rupa's not full-time, he's a householder now.
Well...
Didn't you recognize it?
No,
who she is?
Yeah, but still is working for...
Yeah, full-time.
Full-time for the temple, right?
But, I mean, that's fine, but he should have the expectations There's no practical way that ISKCON can maintain. I mean, if you look at the economics of the situation,
there's a lot of money.
There's a lot of money. And the only way that ISKCON can maintain people or the Catholic Church is when you have a proportion of 99 to 1. In other words, 99% of your people are on the outside contributing a large amount of money. 1% of your people are inside. I mean, that's a rough percentage, but I sort of worked that out before. You got to have that percentage. Because if you've got 99% inside, or 80%, or even 50% inside as full-time workers, and 50% outside, the percentage doesn't work out. There's not enough resources. I mean, you got to, this is mathematics, which I excelled in before I joined the Hare Krishna movement. And then when I joined the movement, I forgot about mathematics. But anyway, so then you think it's just Krishna will do it, you know, the movement will do it. But the movement doesn't have the resources to do something like that. I mean, practically speaking, you know, Rupa should understand practically that he should actually be responsible for himself. And, you know, if someone expects that, they should clarify that. You know, am I going to be taken care of for the rest of my life, even when I get disabled? Even if I have Alzheimer's disease, even if I have, is the movement going to take care of me? That's the expectation, but it's not spelled out, nor are people actually thinking like that.
Why should we expect that when we're doing pure devotional service? Why should we expect
But it's when you're living in an institution. You haven't lived in an institution for a long time.
Well, in Rupa's case, like...
Rupa has.
Married, right? I mean, he gave his 20, 30 years, whatever. Like, before...
Yeah, married, but in other words...
He wouldn't have expected anything back.
But psychologically, there's that expectation. Let's say Rupa...
He's not like that. He would not be able to look after it.
Wait a second.
I'm saying that should be our attitude.
No. Wait a second. Let's say Rupa became extremely disabled. This is before he was married and became a rich man like he is now. But let's say Rupa became extremely disabled as a Sankirtan devotee, and then the temple just said... Yeah, that's what I mean. But he would have felt disappointed too. He had that expectation. We all have that expectation. Does everybody understand the point?
Yeah.
He became disabled, and then all of his previous friends said, you know, Rupa, there's really no place in the movement for you right now. If that happened, just think theoretically, there's really no place in the movement for you now. I suggest your parents take care of you now. And then devotees didn't visit him, you know. How would he feel? I mean, maybe he didn't have the expectation, but he would be extremely discouraged. I mean, just practically, because you're giving your life, you're serving, you're being maintained for so many years. It's like your parents telling. What if you go to your parents and you're sick and disabled and your parents have the means to take care of you and they say no? How would you feel? I mean, you're an adult, but how would you feel? I mean, you would just get angry with your parents. Maybe get angry, maybe get depressed. I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can react to that particular situation. So the movement, I think it's very important that we give people practical expectations. You know, about and spell it out. You know, just like when you go to work for a job, they spell out what the responsibilities are, what the expectations you can have, etc. And you have contracts. And one thing that the movement hasn't really spelled these things out, we have to be a little bit more professional with these things. So, anyway, so getting back to the point, I mean, I don't know if I want to get into that, but that's why people get very resentful. Because they have these expectations. It's understandable. I'm not finding fault in them. All I'm saying is I understand why they're resentful. Because if the same thing happened to me, you know, I might be resentful too. You know, so I mean, fortunately, you know, the gurus don't have to worry about that stuff because they got disciples taking care of it. Like one time someone said to me, you know, Maharaj, do you have any old age pension? And I said, yes, but they didn't understand what I was talking about. I was talking about disciples anyway. And they said, wow, you're taking Krishna's money and putting it into a pension. I said, no, I'm not doing that. You know, there's people all over the world who take care of me. You know, if I come to Krishna Vijaya and I say, I'm dying, he'll say, okay, I'll take care of you. He's not going to, I mean, that's more than the movement, isn't it? The movement doesn't have facility for this. I mean, you have to be practical. I'm not saying the movement has to have it. At this stage, it can't have because it doesn't have the resources. The resources come from grihasthas in the Varnashram system, right? You know, so I know if I came here, I was dying. You know, Krishna Vijaya, I'm dying, you know, that he'd say, all right, Maharaj, you know, stay here and we'll arrange and Govardhan will take care of you. Or we'll give you free medical care, or at least a reduced rate for medical care. But no, seriously, I mean, because it's different. Sannyasa is different. You know, sannyasa actually has his own, like, usually wherewithal. But for the brahmacharis, I mean, it's, we should be very careful in giving expectations to people like that. And then they become bitter. I mean, I see that even with the householders who've been serving for many years, if their expectations are not fulfilled, they actually get bitter or disappointed or discouraged. So I'm actually trying to demonstrate how we can be empathic with people who get negative. Because really, if we went through that, we might be negative too. Yeah, I mean, as long as things are spelled out, like it's a contractual thing, the temple is going to give you a certain percentage you can put into your retirement fund if you're a brahmachari, that's fine. But the thing is, when it's not spelled out, then the expectations develop that are unrealistic.
We don't do that in our temples. We don't spell it out.
No, we don't spell it out. You know, what are your long-term expectations? Yeah.
So many devotees did the service and then been kicked out because they're disabled or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's very upsetting. It's very upsetting.
Looking from outside, it's just like you work for a firm.
And they kick you out.
Kicked out, but hey, they didn't say they were going to take care of you for life.
Yeah, but implicitly they gave the expectation. See, the problem.
I mean, then, as you said, I mean, like, would you want to be part of a company that does that to you?
No, you wouldn't be one part of the company. So what ISKCON has to do managerially is spell out what you can expect, basically.
Managing expectations.
Managerial, you know, personal expectations, health expectations, and this is, you know, contracts. That's it, you know. And also on the other side, sometimes you bring people from India to be a pujari, and there's no contract. You just expect they're going to be a pure devotee serving the deities. But then as soon as they get their residency, what happens? You don't see them again. You don't see it. So there should be also expectation. All this should be written down on paper, isn't it? And therefore you avoid bitterness and confusion when you write things down, what the expectations are. We expect you to serve the deities for 2 years after you get your residency. You know, and that should be a contract. I mean, of course, it's not enforceable by law, those contracts. But still, the expectations are clear. So you don't have so much bitterness or recriminations afterwards. Okay, I think that's all we have time for. We have an expectation to take care of the deities and eat. Okay? All glories to the Bhagavad Gita.